Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. And I'm now here with Mike from Imperium Press. So Imperium Press is a publishing company. And well, Mike, would you like to welcome to Millennial, and would you like to introduce people to Imperium Press?
Thanks very much, Woz. And thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate that. Yeah, so Imperium Press, this is a publishing company that has been in the works for a couple of years, but really only got going and was launched in September of 2019. We had a couple of books come out. And so we bill ourselves as the classics department of the dissident right, or perhaps you could say the alt-right. And it has a sort of a story behind it. But yeah, that's basically the idea, is that it's for us to sort of reclaim our own canon, essentially, and the intellectual high ground from the left, which has obviously been hegemonic in terms of, at least in terms of the academic world for some time now. This is sort of a beginning to rectify that. And at least, you know, just as a sort of limited scope in terms of what it's about, is just to sort of reframe some of the books that make up our own canon, because a lot of times they get really paused when you're reading some of these editions. And that was part of the origin story of Imperium Press. So it actually started when, of all things, I was putting together a book of folk tales for my kids, sort of an unlikely origin story for a dissident right publisher, but in a heavily expanded form, this folktales book is actually going to be released next year. It's going to be one of the books that comes out. It's going to be called Folktales in the Indo-European Tradition, and basically it's a collection of folktales with origins in the remote past, going back to the Indo-European homeland, which is really interesting. There was a study published in 2015 that basically sort of upended a lot of thinking about like how old folk tales are. A lot of them are older than a lot of most of our religious literature. So anyway, and I've been watching the alt-right for many, many years and sort of participating in limited capacities myself, but I hadn't really jumped in with both feet. But this folk tales book obviously has potential for European identity. So that kind of put publishing on my radar. And at about the same time, I got hold of a few Cambridge University Press editions of like classic right-wing books, things like Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil and a selection of Baudin's writings on sovereignty and whatnot, quite a few of these. And, you know, I'm familiar with Nietzsche, but a lot of them I hadn't read before. But I could even just tell, just reading these Cambridge editions, I was just absolutely incensed reading them, because they're framed in extremely shitty ways. Like, the editors, they clearly do not like these books. They don't like the authors, and they want to make sure that you don't like them either. And you can tell just by reading the introductions and everything. In some cases, even just the blurbs on the cover. And it seems like the only reason they publish these books is so that someone like me wouldn't. Like if you take a look at the Cambridge edition of Baudin, Jean Baudin, on sovereignty, it says right on the cover that he's wrong and that he's only important as a sort of historical development towards something else. So it's essentially sort of like the equivalent of the intellectual dark web. It's sort of a backstop, or like walling off where you shouldn't be allowed to go intellectually. So anyway, reading these books at this point, the idea of putting something together in terms of publishing started forming in my mind. So I started contacting bloggers and other people in the alt-right and neo-reactionary sphere. And at this time, back in about 2017, when it started forming, the alt-right was a lot less sort of formed than it is now. It was a little bit more like a confederacy of ideas. And anyway, I started contacting people that I really appreciated, and I asked them if they'd be interested in writing up introductions for these books. And honestly, I'm totally astonished that anybody took me up, because nobody knew who I was. I had zero reputation. And I ended up getting some seriously heavy hitters that were decided to write introductions and help me out with that. So in a nutshell, that's kind of where things started, and gives you a bit of an idea where we are now.
And that was in 2017.
Yeah, I think I think I actually formed the company like formally in 2018, but the ideas had started to burble and, you know, they were in the background there about that time.
It's impressive, and I'm glad that you got in touch with me to appear on Millennial, and you could have done it last year or even in 2018, and I would have had you on then, because this is exactly the kind of thing that I want to promote and I want more of. I think that this is what we need is high quality things. You know, we need things that have an air of prestige about them and integrity. Because so much is not like that in the movement. And that's not to disparage the movement. It's just, I'm just saying that this is something we clearly need. It's authoritative voices, to use the expression that's become fashionable recently. It is interesting what you say about the mainstream, how even when they do make these texts available, it's with an eye to discredit them and wall them off as something that is... It's here just to sate your curiosity, but it, for God's sake, don't take it seriously, kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you say that we need high quality things, I absolutely agree. Like, there's so much talent in the dissident right. I don't know whether to call it the dissident right or the alt right. I'm just going to call it the alt right because it's essentially a continuation of one of the other. In the alt-right, there's a lot of potential. There's a lot of sort of, and a lot of it is coming into shape. It's starting to become more formed. And this is part of why the mainstream has taken such a hard line against it. There's a lot of potential there. And when you say that we need nice things, nicer things, I agree with that 100%. And I sort of think of that as we need to build institutions. We need to, like, you know, there's quite a few publishing companies have sort of popped up in the last eight or 9 months or something like that. And, you know, this is a good development. This is exactly what we need. Not only that, but we also need music labels. We need theater companies. We need people working on crypto, you know, cryptography. We need people who are doing art, like you had American Zarathustra on. I really enjoyed that one. And he's a friend of ours, and I really appreciate what the White Art Collective is doing. We need all these things. It needs to be a sort of total, like, you know, solution kind of thing. Where, say, for example, in the election, there was 2020 in general, you've talked a lot about this with your guests. I won't go on too much about 2020 unless we have time to discuss it. But basically what happened was there was a huge opportunity to take control of the narrative for us to basically reframe things in ways that, you know, are suitable to what we want to have happen. And unfortunately, at the moment, we're just not quite there yet. You know, we don't have this media, alternative media empire. It's getting there. There's certainly some really important work being done. But there was an opportunity within the first, like, I would say about the first 3 days of, you know, 18 hours into the election, what was going on in five states simultaneously. I'm not sure how much we can really talk about that on YouTube. But all these procedural outcomes that seem to have gone in a certain way all of a sudden, there was an opportunity for us to take control of that narrative. And basically, you know, with all this, the Benford's Law stuff is, you know, yes. if we had someone who was like an expert, like a team of expert mathematicians on retainer, and we're able to just sort of tap that expertise and say, look, we need you to get on this, and in 12 hours, we need something put together. We need a full analysis done. And then, boom, it's out there on all these alternative media channels. There was a chance for us to really move the needle and actually do something and make a big difference. We're not quite there, and hopefully there will... You know, we won't see the eye of Sauron won't focus too much on us in 2021, although, you know, we are going to go through a difficult period. But basically, over the next year or two, we have an opportunity to build those parallel institutions. And I think that, and we can talk a little bit about the actual books that we've published if you like. There's one in particular That is
just before we go into that. I do completely agree with you about this, and I've said it in a previous one this year that I think we need our own institutions, but we also need our own ecosystem and the ways that these institutions are connected to each other and can consult and utilize each other. That needs to be built. I think that would happen organically anyway. But the other thing we need is, when I say ecosystem, is an economic ecosystem, because that is going to be a massive problem for us. And there's a lot to be said there. But I think that we should not underestimate what will be done to thwart dissident activity and dissident content creation and so on. I think that we should not think that this is going to be easy, because it's not. And that's not to discourage you or anyone else. I'm just saying this is the scope of it. We need our own economic system. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, we certainly do. And the alt-right has been really strong on a few things in terms of a few categories. It's very aesthetically strong. The mimetic warfare that was going on from 2015 through about 2017 was absolutely debilitating to the left and to the mainstream, which is why Hillary Clinton decided to address it directly. Like, they wouldn't have done that if it wasn't a threat.
That was in August 2016, the Reno speech, when she said that she linked the alt-right to Donald Trump and to Putin. And I think also to the KKK. I can't remember exactly now, but she came up with a bunch of stuff and Alex Jones, that was the big thing as well. And all of this
it's
was
all
connected.
Just fascism to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Well, that's the point. That was when she did it, and because memes were indeed very powerful. Now, I'm not sure about the expression "the left can't meme." That's a discussion in itself, but clearly, the alt-right did have a huge advantage in 2016 in terms of its ability to quickly and amusingly convey ideas, complex ideas. So, it was only natural that they would clamp down on that.
Yeah, and the alt-right's really good for that. We, in terms of aesthetics, like, 4chan is basically this womb of nations of aesthetic power. Like, it really does have quite a reach. And there's a meme about that too. So the alt-right's very strong on that. But there's some dimensions that the alt-right is not that strong on. And those are often to do with the sort of technical side of things. To sort of circle back a little bit to the point that you'd made just before this, we do need our own payment processors. We need some sort of cryptographic security measures, like operational security. These are all things that we need people working on. There's a lot of people doing political theory, and that's really, really important. We do need to know where we're going ahead of time. We can't just kind of stumble blindly into, you know, a cul-de-sac like liberalism has essentially done itself. But at the same time, we need praxis. There's been a lot of theory and not a whole lot of praxis. And that is something that is absolutely required if the movement sort of going forward is going to be successful. 2021 is going to be a very difficult year, because what I think is going to happen anyway is that things are going to get very bad for a while. And people are panicking over this, and they kind of have a reason to panic. But it's only going to get bad for a short while. Ultimately, the power structure of the deep state was not really that harmed in the past 4 years. I mean, it was harmed in a way in that people sort of started to wake up to the fact that there's an alternative, and that, in fact, liberalism does have a totalitarian dimension to it. I mean, the man in the street can't deny that after this election. There's just, that has been a disaster for them. But in terms of actual, like, wielding of hard power, the deep state was not really harmed by the alt-right in the past 4 years. So it's still relatively stable. So once a round of social media purges goes on, once Biden takes office, the deep state will sort of it'll start to feel itself to be a bit more secure at that point. And I think once these purges end, or once the initial round of purges, you see this hurricane of just people getting deplatformed and, like, you know, lawsuits and things, that will sort of relax a little bit. And in a way, things will kind of be better for us under Biden than would have been under Trump. And this is something that Richard Spencer has actually been saying, and I think a lot of people have given him flack for that. But I think that's actually correct. If Trump had gone in, it would have just been pedal to the metal acceleration. Like, we've seen a big, big acceleration for the past 4 years, and especially in the last, you know, 9 months or so. But the acceleration would have been like nitro level had Trump, if Trump manages to get back in, which, you know, I mean, whatever you think of the possibility of that. But if Biden gets in, I think the deep state's going to sort of say, okay, yeah, we can't let this happen again. But at the same time, it's not full, you know, full press warfare the way it would be if Trump had gotten in. So, yeah.
Oh, that would be insane. If Trump had won the election, it would have, the press reaction would have been absolutely hysterical. And that would have carried over into Antifa, of course, on the streets.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Well, this is the whole thing, is that the 2020 election has been quite, it has been bad for them. Joe Biden won, but that's about all you can say about it, right? 2016.
Yeah, he's not an inspiring guy. They're now stuck with him. They're going to have to work with him now as this face, this puppet of the deep state.
Yeah, and he's really only an ornament. He doesn't really matter ultimately. I mean, this is Trump's legacy, right? And this is part of why they hate him. They hate him for so many reasons, and this is one of them, is that the presidency, which is what most people think of as the sum and substance of democracy, does not matter at all, right? If it did, things would probably look very different. There would be a wall. You know, there would be quite a whole range of different policies that have been enacted. But instead, Trump kept, like, getting stymied at every point. So normal people are sort of starting to realize that democracy isn't a thing, and that's unforgivable. So Trump's in big trouble. I don't know why he's sort of not taking this more seriously, because I think his family is going to get Romanov'd. But anyway, the last 4 years have been the point where the left has kind of started to panic. And they really expected, especially the sort of like wine ant, cat lady, sort of pussy hat contingent has really started. Like, they expected a total rebuke of Trump. They thought he was going to get crushed. But instead, Trump gets millions more votes than in 2016, even if you buy the mainstream narrative. And this was supposed to be the referendum on Trumpism. But it was. This is the problem. What they've realized is that MAGA was not an aberration, but it's something that they're going to have to live
yes.
with forever.
Yes, and that's it. Yeah, indeed. I want to veer away from this topic for reasons which we discussed earlier. But yeah, this is now something that's going to remain in the, what's the word, in the body politic? I forgot what the term is, but in the public consciousness, that this is something that they're going to have to, it's going to linger for a long time because, white Americans had a taste of something and they now realize that it's possible.
We'll put it this way, and sort of then we can leave it to the side. The mask has slipped, and it can't unslip, and that's a big problem. They were hoping it would sort of remain concealed for the next couple of generations.
Yes, yes, indeed. So if we perhaps get to the authors that you were going to talk about earlier with Imperium Press, because I think people will want to know what kind of books you are. So you said that you do... republish old texts, old books. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah. So the initial sort of impetus for the publishing company was to take old books that have sort of been framed in ways that are sort of leading you back to liberalism, like taking these illiberal texts and framing them in ways, sanitizing them, you could think of, and unsanitizing them, making them radioactive again, basically. I mean, the texts speak for themselves, but they're sort of sandwiched in between you know, introductions, like 60-page introductions that tell you why you shouldn't really take it that seriously. So that is, you know, something that we wanted to rectify. That was the original idea. But then, you know, getting in touch with authors who had written introductions for us, it just so happened, and this wasn't planned, that we decided to publish some new books. And the authors that we've been working with are people that I really respect, that we really respect, that are doing excellent, you know, analytical work, theoretical work on their own. And so we've actually published two new books by contemporary authors. And there's a third one that's coming out. You've spoken to Josh Neal before, and we can talk a bit about his book because it's really quite groundbreaking. But yeah, it's actually a mix of old and new books, which was not something that was originally intended. So it's cool. I like the fact that Imperium Press is taking on a life of its own. It's not just my thing. It's not just our thing, like with the people involved. It's sort of its own thing. It's sort of living its own life. And I think that's a very good sign, actually.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when something starts to become a group endeavor, that instead of just your bedroom project, that, I mean, obviously there's a pleasure to having something just being your own thing, your bedroom project, but eventually there is a threshold that gets crossed, and that is a sign of, you know, great achievement.
Yeah, no, I'm surprised in a way that it's done as well as it has. Like, you know, people, we get constant interaction about the publishing company, so that's really cool. People really like it. And, you know, it just sort of indicates my original thought that there's an appetite for this sort of thing, for this kind of publishing, for us to take control of our own canon and our own narrative. And yeah, it's been very rewarding. So we put out 5 books so far, 6 if you count a translation. We've got the first book actually that came out was The Iliad. And, I mean, this was a fitting sort of beginning for us. It's the cornerstone of the Western canon. We couldn't not start with it in a way. And we put out a translation by an American poet in the 19th century who put out a very direct, it's in a poetic meter. It's in the epic meter of English, which is iambic pentameter, blank verse, but it's also very direct. So it's a great translation. It turns out it was out of print. So we put that out. And then I contacted, you know, I've been contacting quite a few people, and we managed to get Ricardo Duchesne to write the introduction to it for us. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but anybody who's not, he is a Canadian professor, actually an ex-professor now. He was teaching at the University of New Brunswick. And I can't believe this guy lasted as long as he did, because he put out this book in, I think, 2011 called The Uniqueness of Western Culture. And it's basically sort of a forerunner to everything that we've been saying about, you know, the value of Western culture and the fact that it isn't a universal thing and it's our thing. And it's just red pills sort of from top to tail, this book. Anyway, he wrote that, and I got in touch with him, and I asked him to sort of expand a bit on some of one of the things that he was talking about in there, which was the Indo-European roots of Homer. And that's what he's done. He's written out this excellent essay for us that serves as the introduction to Iliad. And I can't believe that we got him on board, especially when we hadn't published anything. So that's one of the books. We could talk about the new books in a sec, I guess. But the other old book that we've put out so far is this book called The Ancient City, which is sort of a turning point for me intellectually. What it is, ostensibly, is it's an explanation of how the classical world kind of collapsed and gave way to sort of the Christian era, not the modern era, but the early Middle Ages kind of thing. And it does so in a way that's very unique. Basically, what it explains is it explains it in terms of the religion that, you know, Rome and Greece had a very similar sort of religious milieu. And that ultimately goes back to, again, the Indo-European sort of common root that they share. And ultimately, I mean, to give you the total TLDR, it comes down to ancestor worship. And it's fascinating because the first two books basically are the author, who's a French academic in the 19th century, setting out what the ancient Indo-European religion was, the ancestor worship sort of at the bottom of all the sort of Zeus and Jupiter and Poseidon mythos. And it's fascinating because you can really sort of see the echoes of this is sort of the illiberal religion par excellence. And you can kind of see where a lot of what we appreciate in terms of the illiberal or the dissident or the alt-right is embodied in this religion that was a going concern something like 5,000 years ago. So it's absolutely fascinating. And it also explains, you know, the fall of Rome and, you know, the sort of end of the Greek classical age in ways that are just far, far more insightful than anything I've ever read. So that was a really interesting book.
And what was that one called?
It's called The Ancient City.
Right, okay.
And then we've got the two new books that we've done so far. One of them is, it's called Nemesis, and it was written by a gentleman by the name of Chris Bond, who used to blog as Reactionary Future. He was involved in the neo-reactionary sphere. And what the book basically does is it takes the high-low versus middle mechanism that was pioneered by Bertrand de Jouvenel, which is it's basically a theory of social change and how revolutions happen. And essentially, it's how power works, this high-low versus middle mechanism. Chris Bond takes this mechanism and he applies it to things that Jouvenel never did. Jouvenel was a historian working in the aftermath of World War I. He was mostly concerned with the early modern era, sort of the transition from the feudal age to, you know, the French Revolution and on into sort of the modern era. Talked a little tiny bit about, you know, things like the 1917 revolution in Russia. But he was writing in 1948. He had no idea, obviously, that anything was going, what was going to happen later in terms of the civil rights era in the U.S., in terms of feminism, in terms of gay rights, in terms of Black Lives Matter, radical Islam, all these things. So what Chris Bond does is he takes this high-low versus middle mechanism, which is almost like a skeleton key to explaining power and like how things happen in the modern era, and he uses it, applies it to all those things I just mentioned, all the modern developments since 1960. And he does it in such a way that it just actually one of our other authors reviewed it in a magazine. And he said it's a relentless demolition of liberal concepts. And that's exactly what it is. You basically can't read this book and take it seriously and come out on the other side of it as still like a convinced liberal. So that's Nemesis. That's a really interesting one.
All right.
Yeah. And there's one more. I'll briefly describe it before I shut up here. It's called Anthropomorphics, and it was written by a gentleman by the name of Adam Katz, who is a really interesting researcher in generative anthropology. And it's kind of hard to summarize because it's very theoretical, but it's also really groundbreaking. Basically, what it does is it sort of focuses on the what you could call the center phobia of liberalism. So liberalism has to hide the fact that there's a central authority, whether it's a god or a proposition, like we hold these truths to be self-evident, or a hallowed minority identity or whatever. It has to kind of hide the fact that there is a center around which the society is constructed. This is where we get Popper's paradox of tolerance. Adam's got a generative anthropology has a whole origin of the, you know, basically the origin of humanity, essentially, in terms of language, where language came from. And it's based on this centeredness. And so what's happened is in the modern era, especially with liberalism has to hide the fact that there's a center. So the occupied center, which is, let's just call it the government or the sovereign, is there's a gap between that and the signifying center, which is sort of the proposition at the heart of the society. And this gap is exactly how liberalism sort of just swells in terms of like a cancer. It just how it multiplies in terms of its totalitarian power. And Adam's, again, to give you the TLDR, Adam's solution here, or at least one of the many solutions, is that we need to rigorously sort of study the signifying center, so the philosophical basis of liberalism, and then study the occupied center, the sovereign, and explain that there is this gap, and then close the gap, basically. And if you can't close the gap, that, you know, if you explain how that gap cannot be closed, basically what it does is liberalism sort of collapses of its own weight. So that's Anthropomorphics. Lots of really interesting books here. And yeah, I just basically summarized them all. So there you go. Oh,
thank you. That's useful for people. And I'm sure that people will investigate further on your own website, of course, imperiumpress.org. I guess that brings us to the new book that you're bringing out, which I did have Josh Neal on a few nights ago, and we talked about all sorts of things, but he didn't seem to want to talk about the book in much depth, I think, because it was woven into the conversation, because we were talking about 2020, and he said that the book is effectively a sort of travelogue of, you know, just going through, progressing through 2020. So it was talked about in that way. But would you like to describe the book in your own way?
Sure. So yeah, I was really excited.
I should just say that you did say that it was groundbreaking. So don't let me down here.
No. Well, we'll go into that for sure. And I really enjoyed your interview with Josh as well. Millennials are always great. It's so nice for people to be able to sort of discover these new personalities that they haven't seen. So thank you for that. I will also mention, just like in 3 seconds here, that we have another book. It's an interview with Jonathan Bowden. And this one it's almost like a sort of, it's a great sort of first red pill for anybody that is a liberal. It's called Why I Am Not a Liberal, and it explains just that. And this guy, if you're not familiar with Jonathan Bowden, unfortunately, he's gone now, but he was a great orator and a very interesting guy. So it's a good, you know, Christmas present for your dad or something, your boomer dad. Anyway, so American Extremist by Josh Neal. This is a psychoanalysis of extremism, both of the left and the right, which is really interesting, because you'd think that it would just be mostly he's looking at the left, but we're talking about violent extremists and their enablers, which is part of the innovative part. You know, the people who like put the gun in the hand of the Black Lives Matter activist and say, do something. You know, we're talking about CNN. We're talking about like Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow, these people. They are extremists in their own way. So anyway, there are so many red pills in this book, American Extremists. It's hard to focus on just one or two, but I think the major value of the book is to expand on the definition of extremism. And Josh makes the case that things like the ADL, social justice, woke capital, and other like mainstream phenomena are extremists, and they seem, you know, this seems quite almost transparent to us these days because it's part of the mainstream. Like, it's easy to think of right-wing extremism, or maybe like a socialist extremist, or certainly a fascist extremist. But like, what comes to mind? Woz, I'll ask you this: what comes to mind when you think of liberal extremism?
Sorry, I just put something in. I just got a chocolate biscuit.
No worries. So anyway, it was sort of a rhetorical question.
I would say something like a CNN newsreader or journalist who cannot thole anything but their version of reality.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that like it's everywhere. Liberal extremism is ubiquitous, but like most people who are just sort of like center left, like they sort of lean a little bit left, but they're not too far out there. They can't think of anything. Like, liberal extremism it's almost like an oxymoron. And yet liberalism itself is one of the most radical, if not the most radical, ideologies in all of history. So anyway, the fact that liberal extremism is kind of this, you know, black hole, isn't because liberalism is normal or the default position or anything. It's because we're swimming in it. So I think this is one of the most significant things about the book. Another thing that's worth talking about is the sheer number of studies that Josh cites that are useful to our side.
Well, just on the matter of the liberal extremism, you know, it's easy, and I've made this point many times myself, but it's easy to forget that what so-called extreme right-wingers, right-wing extremists, I will leave aside the people who are actually terrorists and violent and whatever. People who are just thinkers and speakers, commentators. We get called extremists, but all we're actually advocating, you know, to the extent that we advocate something for society, what we're advocating is a return to what our grandparents took for granted, absolutely for granted, and what our parents could still pretty much take for granted, that the world 50 years from now will be basically the same as the world that I know here and now. And I'm not saying that I want to return to the 70s or the 90s or the 2000s, but definitely I think that it is, what I want is not an extremist thing. It's not totalitarian. It's actually very reasonable. It's what our ancestors certainly were able to take for granted for all of their existence, thousands and thousands of years. So, and also just sanity in terms of social mores around LGBT sexuality and so on. I can't believe that to advocate, you know, the traditional nuclear family for most people, not for everyone, but for the vast majority of people, that, how is that an extremist position? That is just crazy. Whereas the LGBT gay-friendly or pro-gay feminists, third-wave feminists, trans stuff, all of that, that is surely extreme. I would say that's extreme. That's talking about negating the very idea of male and female, negating marriage, negating the family. Surely that's extremism. That seems like extremism to me. And this is what's so scary about the mainstream media today, that they advocate these things and don't seem to realize that they're being extremists, that what they're advocating is extreme. I don't know how they manage to somehow be this divorced from nature and from tradition and just history, and somehow convince themselves that what they're advocating is moderate. It's incredible, really, that they've managed that.
Yeah, well, there's a reason why they're able to do that. But, I mean, if you want to think about, like, how far off the timeline we've come, and this is sort of the whole thing about liberalism, is that it's things get weirder and weirder and weirder, and you just don't know. Like, it doesn't make any sense why. And then they sort of look back at the past when something was, like, maybe not perfectly normal, but like a little bit more historically normal. And they just, like, it's just absolutely appalling to them. Like, it's repellent to these people, right? Like, you know, not to advocate this or anything, or nor not advocate it. But if you look at sort of, you know, fascist Germany in the middle of the 20th century, you know, these are the people that are the, like, immediate descendants of people like Goethe and Schiller and Immanuel Kant and all, like, you know, these titans, the intellectual Hegel, and these titans. And, like, the liberal explanation for how we got, you know, how we got to fascism in Germany is just that, you know, the banality of evil. Like, what a ridiculous, like, under explanation. That's just crazy to me. Yeah. You know,
and it is. And also the other explanation is just that the public went crazy in absolute insanity because they were hoodwinked by a very clever, devious, manipulative liar.
Well, I mean, if that's your explanation, it's like, yeah, well, okay, yeah, see you later, democracy, right? Like, are these really the people who should be, like, the people? Should they have any say at all if they're just basically, like...
Well, Well, the same people who make that argument that I just made will say the same thing about Trump in 2016. I mean, I've seen him likened to Hitler, which is just incredible, really. But let's really be careful what we say here.
Logic of liberalism, what sort of leads it to be so extreme, sort of bring it back to Josh's book and the extremity aspect, is this centrophobia that I mentioned, right? Like, the idea, the sort of procedural algorithm of liberalism is take whatever is at the center, whether it's an ethnic majority or whether it's a proposition or whatever, or God or whatever, and replace it with what's on the margin, right? Like put the margin at the center and then wait a little while, and then that will be the center. And then you take that center and you replace it with something yet more marginal. And then like the algorithm just continues to run, and it continues to run off the rails further and further away from anything that is at all sane and normal. And this is why like liberalism is basically an engine for the creation of extremity. And the reason why it's able to do this is because it's also based on historical amnesia. Like, you're supposed to not learn from the past. You're supposed to forget about the past. That doesn't matter anymore. This is like linear history. This is the idea behind that. So that's how liberalism, you know, that's the mechanism by which it becomes so extreme. But there's also sort of always an undercurrent that, you know, sort of going in the background that can't be stopped. And that's, you know, just basically the sort of brute fact of that people are what they are. They're not you can't use social constructionism to sort of destroy, you know, people's natural instincts. And, you know, one of the white pills, I mentioned that Josh drops a lot of studies in this, and like really it's worth it to read it just for that, for them alone. One of the huge white pills is this study called The Hidden Resilience and Adaptive Dynamics of the Global Online Hate Ecology. I think that's what it is. And the TLDR here is that deplatforming can hurt particular individuals, but in the long run, it does nothing to slow down extremism. So it's a huge black pill for these people, and it's something that
what they call extremism.
Yeah,
let's qualify that. What is his argument for that? Because I've never heard that before.
Whose argument? The
well, Josh Neal. I mean, why does he say that deplatforming does not slow down the spread of alternative ideas?
This is just a study that he cites. This isn't Josh's argument. This is the argument of the, you know, woke activist academic, which is amazing, right? Like they're saying, it's like they're putting out this huge black pill and saying like, look guys, deplatforming hurts individuals. Like, you know, deplatforming hurts particular individuals. But in the end, the actual, what they call the global online hate ecology continues to thrive. And so this is an epic white pill that we need to chew, right? And the book's full of hundreds of citations like that. It's amazing. So before I, you know, we can move on from Josh's book, one last thing that makes it so worthwhile is that Josh makes a really fair assessment of both left and right extremism. So there's been just a mountain of studies written about the dysfunction, psychological dysfunction of the right. But there's almost nothing about the dysfunction of the left. So this in itself is really valuable. But Josh, he also shows how a lot of the classic psychological destruction of the right is total nonsense, like Adorno, Eric Fromm, these people. And then he goes on, he offers his own analysis, which is really penetrating and honest, of the dysfunction of the right, but also the dysfunction of the left. Now, I mean, this is not a sort of like cucked, like sensible centrism or anything like that. He's not telling us like what's wrong with our guys. He's not even really, he's not talking about like you and I or like any of the audience. He's talking about people who actually want to go out there and murder people, people who we shouldn't be associating with anyway. But he does sort of offer a very honest sort of assessment of the extreme psychology of the right and the left. And this is what's so groundbreaking about it, is that almost nobody has done this in terms of, you know, explaining what makes the left tick psychologically. And he does that. It's really penetrating and fantastic. And the fact that he expands the definition of extremism to encompass like Cenk Uygur or whatever, and all that, people like that, people who call for violence against us, it really does our side a big service. So this could be a bit of a game changer. I agree with him when he says that this could be something quite big. So really excited about it.
Well, excellent. I mean, I should probably have him on to promote the book when it's released. When is it going to be released?
It's going to come out in January.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, I think we should maybe wrap it up there so that this is a nice, concise advert for Imperium Press. Is there anything else that you'd like people to know about Imperium Press?
Well, there's quite a lot sort of coming down the pipe. 2021 is going to be a super busy year for us. We've got a few projects, lots of books coming out. So anyone who's familiar with us, is like a lot of people have been clamoring and saying, like, why don't you release stuff faster and everything like that. We put out 4 books in the past year. So that our release schedule is going to intensify, basically, is what I'm saying. There's a lot that's 90% complete that we're getting very close, and we're going to start putting out a lot more. Another thing that's coming is one of the projects is we're putting out this thing called the syllabus, which I'm really excited about. This is one of the best things I think we might ever do, which is, it's essentially a series of reading lists, which sounds pretty prosaic, but think of it as like a college syllabus on various topics. So say you want to learn, you know, all there is to know about Christian theology or the American Civil War or National Socialism or any other number of topics. If you went into a college course on one of these topics, you get a syllabus. They'd hand you a reading list. And in the university system, these course reading lists are very carefully curated over decades. And the idea is basically to foreclose on any possibility of you thinking outside of liberal categories. So even when it's a course on like fascist movements or whatever, you're going to read The Doctrine of Fascism by Gentile and Mussolini, but you're also going to read a mountain of secondary literature that's going to prep you to not take that shit seriously at all. And will basically act as a gloss or like a set of footnotes that explains what's wrong with it. So your mind will basically be made up ahead of time. So we're going to sort of act as the countervailing force there. And there's going to be a series of very comprehensive reading lists that come out that sort of like, you know, they explain what you need to be looking at. And, you know, we're not going to pretend it'll be ideologically neutral. I mean, nothing ever is. But it's going to take these topics very seriously and explain things from an illiberal right-wing perspective. So that'll be cool. Another project we have in the works is we're going to reissue, not sure if it's one volume or if it'll be multiple volumes, but we're going to reissue many of the major works of fascism in the 20th century. Some of this stuff hasn't even been translated. And a lot of it, like, you know, Italian fascism, most people, if you were asked to explain what the philosophical dimensions were behind, say, Mussolini or, you know, Falangism or anything like that, most people couldn't really do it, even on our side. So, I mean, some guys like Culture Thug and whatnot, like he's helping us out with this, as far as he's helping us with the syllabus anyway. So, that has been really, really cool. We're going to put together the major works of fascism and reissue that stuff so that people will be able to read it for themselves and make up their own mind about it. We're also going to be putting together a course on Latin, if this is something that's very close to my heart. If you want to learn Latin, there's a few different methods that you can use to do that. None of them are really all that satisfactory. We're going to use some more traditional methods for teaching Latin. And lots of people have been asking us about this. This is something that we get asked about quite a lot. So that's going to come up probably later in the year. There's a lot happening with Imperium Press. And I wish it could be my full-time job. If people want to help out with that, buy some books for your friends. You know, we've got a donate button on our website. I want this to basically be what I do. I want to be doing a service to the alt-right, to the dissident right. And, you know, this is what I want to be doing. So it's just wonderful that people have chimed in and expressed so much gratitude and appreciation for what we're doing. So, yeah, that's probably a good place to leave it.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I hope that this people will go and look at imperiumpress.org. It's linked below. So good luck with it all. And it does sound very interesting for numerous different reasons. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you, Mike from Imperium Press. And I'll be back in about 15 minutes with the distributor. So that'll be the last one for this evening. In the meantime, thank you again, Mike, and everyone else. I'll see you later. Bye for now.
Thanks for having me on.
All right.